Members, this meeting will come to order. This is our 15th meeting of the 87th session, and considering the fact that we're never going to stop meeting, I'll just get to increase those numbers as we go along. We are delighted to have an addition. We didn't like to see the loss of Lyndon Carlson, but we have joining us now Tom Tilbury because of the special election. Some rearranging of members serving on committees has occurred, and we welcome you, Representative Tilbury. And would you just introduce yourself in regard to your district and tell us a little bit about your interests?
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Tom Tilbury, District 51B, which is Fridley, Spring Lake Park, Mounds View, and the southern part of Blaine. And it's great to be back here. I was here my first term. And then I went to K-12 finance. And then I think they got a little bit of confusion. They put me on judiciary. And maybe because they thought that I was a counselor, that somehow that meant lawyer. And, you know, that's how I got put on there. But I'm glad to be back.
Well, it's great to have you as a counselor in our schools, too. We know how important that staff is to our students' future and to our students every day in our schools. So we do welcome you. With that said, please look over the minutes, members. And I would like to ask Representative Kiefer to move the minutes if she has looked them over carefully.
I have. Thank you, Madam Chair. I move to approve the minutes.
Representative Kiefer moves the minutes of February 22nd. Are there any additions or corrections other than those that are technical that will change? Seeing none and hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, nay. The minutes are adopted, and we will move to our agenda. This is a Reform Committee, members, as you know, and so today we're going to hear a bill that I believe former Representative Barb Sikora first introduced to the veterans on this committee. And, you know, as I look around, I don't see a single veteran who remembers that. Oh, maybe Representative Sandra Peterson. Were you here when Barb Sikora might have introduced the qualified economic offer?
I don't recall it.
No. So then I think I'm the only one who dates back to that time. So we welcome to our committee Representative Keith Downey, House File 269. And Representative Downey, I will move House File 269, recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Education Finance. I believe you have a couple of amendments, one technical and the other some important change. Representative Downey, I will move the A1 amendment. Will you basically welcome yourself to the committee and explain the amendment for us?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. So the amendment just clarifies the percentage increase that will be used as part of the qualified economic offer determination, and specifies that it's the first year of the biennium, not the two-year period.
All those in favor of adding the A1 amendment to House File 269, please signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed, nay. The amendment is adopted. I will move A2, the 269 A2 amendment. Will you please explain that, Representative Downey?
And thank you, Madam Chair. The A2 simply defines, well, shouldn't say simply because you can see it's actually
explicitly
quite a few components here, but it defines total compensation so that there's no lack of clarity. And I want to thank staff for bringing both of these amendments to our attention and making sure that the bill is very clear in its intent.
So with that, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, nay. The amendment is adopted, and now we have 269 in front of us in the order in which Representative Downey would like it. Please proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. The overriding purposes of this bill are, I think, a few. One, this concept that I think we're all grappling with this legislative session, and that is how do we make sure that kids are first? No excuses, no exceptions, as the chair of our K-12 Finance Committee has admonished us. How do we make sure that everything we're doing in these tough times rotates the resources of the state and our local districts right into the classroom and to the kids? The second is the value of local control, which I know many of us share, and there's a careful and delicate balance there between state policy and requiring outcomes and having some accountability while still at the same time granting the local control to districts to accomplish that. And then the third is, how do we, in this tough time, provide cost control, flexibility, and local cost control? And so the purpose of this bill is to do all of that within the context of what we're doing within the collective bargaining process between the teachers and the local districts. And there have been a lot of discussions about how do we address the cost side of local district operations, a number of bills granting flexibility and control to local districts, and some that have been proposed that would actually mandate a wage freeze down into our districts. And while many of us, myself included, would agree that that's probably got to be part of the solution here, or at least some kind of cost control on the cost of labor side of it, mandating that from the state makes a lot of us uncomfortable. And so this proposal here doesn't mandate it from the state, but what it does say is that if a local district has issued an offer in the bargaining process that is at least equal to the percentage increase in funding coming from the state, that we would preclude the right of teachers to strike on the grounds that the district is fairly representing its financial situation in its contract offer to the teachers. And so it's not a mandate to say you shall not increase, you know, any cost of labor in your district. It's not prescribing a process. The district can opt in and kind of claim this qualified economic offer provision. But it does give them a little extra negotiating position to say if, in fact, they are meeting their fiscal obligations in very tough economic times, that teachers wouldn't have the right to strike in that scenario. So the hope here is that we would empower and give school districts the tools as compared to mandating local cost control on the cost of wages and benefits front. So that's the intention of the bill. The mechanics get tricky, and I know a number of questions have been raised of me of, you know, if this, what happens, if that, what happens, and I welcome the discussion today, and it's very possible there are refinements and improvements that could be made to the bill, but I put it before you with that as the intention and look forward to the discussion.
Thank you very much, Representative Downey. A good piece of reform to debate and to discuss. What becomes of it, we don't know, but we always need to have good ideas in front of us to generate debate. And with that said, I'd like to have those who favor or are supporting this proposal come forth, and we'll keep the timer going up here, and then we'll have those opposed, and then members will open it for questions, because I think if we hear more from those for it and against it, we maybe can raise some better questions. We have the entire meeting period today to discuss this, so welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and begin.
Hello, Madam Chair, members. My name is Jim Bartholomew with the Minnesota Business Partnership. And before I start, I'd like to make it clear that we support teachers. And in fact, we're here asking for your support of House File 269, because it seems every year we see and hear announcements by school districts that they're going through another round of teacher layoffs and cuts in programs.
Excuse me, Mr. Bartholomew, but members, I believe you should have in your packets a handout from the Business Partnership. And if it's not, it's in their packets, right, Michelle? Thank you. So let's probably get that in front of us as Mr. Bartholomew walks through his testimony. Please proceed.
Thank you very much, ma'am. Every time this happens, when districts go through the rounds of teacher layoffs and program cuts, it's the students that are the ones that ultimately pay the price. And one of the key reasons for these regular announcements of teacher layoffs, if school boards have been unable to keep their contract settlements in line with available revenues. In short, districts are agreeing to spend more than they have, and as a result, they have to cut teachers and programs to balance their budgets. We see House File 269, the Qualified Economic Offer, as a critical option, as Representative Downey mentioned, for school boards to keep their teachers and protect programs. Again, as Representative Downey mentioned, in essence, the Qualified Economic Offer, or QEO, allows a school board to say, we're willing to increase your compensation by the same amount of increase we received as a district from the state, but we don't want to spend more and then ultimately have to cut teachers. We're also sure that improvements can be made to House File 269, and we're certainly open to a better strategy for at least limiting the number of teacher layoffs. But from our perspective, the current negotiation structure does not work, and students are suffering because of it. I'd like to anticipate some of the arguments you might hear against the QEO in House File 269 by offering the following, and perhaps this will answer some of the questions coming. The first argument, the QEO eliminates local control over contract negotiations. We'd agree with Representative Downey. This is not true. No one is required to use the QEO. In fact, there may well be school boards that choose to totally ignore it. Nothing will change for them, and that's perfectly fine. Even for those school boards that choose to use the QEO, we'd expect that they'd first negotiate in the same manner as they always have and would use the QEO as a last resort. The QEO is a local option, not a mandate. The second argument, wouldn't increased funding for schools be a better solution for paying or preventing teacher layoffs? And a lot of the focus on teacher layoffs has come from recent state and district deficits. Unfortunately, we've looked at district contract settlement and state funding increase data covering 27 years, going back to 1985. And in 18 of those 27 years, district contract settlements exceeded increases in the state formula. As another example, in 2004, the Minneapolis Star Tribune did an analysis of contract settlements and district funding. As part of their analysis, they found that from 1998 through 2003, 92 districts increased teacher pay over inflation while making cuts in staff. It's fairly obvious that in good times or bad, when the state provides X in funding, school boards typically settle for X plus Y. The third argument, the QEO is a cap on teacher salaries. We'd have two responses to that. First, for those districts that choose to ignore the QEO, there is no impact. For school boards that choose to use it, again, it's presumed that they first tried to negotiate salary increases through their normal process. In addition, there's nothing to say that if a board uses the QEO once, they'll ever use it again. That said, under the QEO, there would likely be a shift to benefits from salary, because under the bill, payment for benefits is the first priority. Our second point, if a school board is faced with the choice of agreeing to salary increases that they can't afford, or trying to provide smaller increases to preserve teacher jobs and programs, we'd argue the smaller increases in keeping teachers is best for students. This is especially true if we're trying to attract and retain younger teachers at a time when half our current teacher workforce is expected to retire over the next 10 years. We are not saying that anyone is doing anything wrong under the current system, and we certainly aren't saying teachers are paid too much. What we are saying is the current system does not work in the best interest of students and certainly for for less senior teachers. We understand that there are a lot of factors involved with these issues, and if there's a better way to give school boards the ability to balance contract costs with available revenues so that they can keep more of their teachers, then we're certainly interested. But the data clearly indicates that the current system is out of balance. We'd like to thank Representative Downey for authoring this legislation, and we'd ask that you would support it. And thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Bartholomew. Are there others who would like to testify in favor of House File 269 as amended? And Mr. Bartholomew, don't go far because there are questions for you. Welcome to the committee. Please say your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Grace Kelleher, and I represent the Minnesota School Boards Association. We would like to thank Representative Downey for bringing this proposal forward and working with us on it. We are very interested in looking to this, and I think you've sort of heard a rendition of this in a couple different ways this year that we're looking at trying to rebalance the bargaining table so that the locally elected school boards have an even footing with teachers going forward, with the ultimate goal of kids getting better service at the end. We certainly believe this qualified economic offer makes some sense. Wisconsin and Iowa both do this. They weren't turned on their heads. The world didn't fall apart. But it gives you some structure in which to start to do these negotiations if you choose to. And Madam Chairman, I will say there will be boards that don't choose to use this tool, and there will be some that do. And it just seems like this is the time when we're looking at an economic crisis that we need to look for solutions outside of the main playbook. So we encourage you to pass this bill forward and once again believe it will be a tool to help boards as they go forward and try to negotiate contracts. Thank you,
Ms. Kelleher, and don't go far, because we will have questions for you. Are there others who would like to testify for House File 269 as amended? Are there those who would like to testify against? I believe Education Minnesota certainly does. Okay, we'll start with Roger Arnson first. And he represents we'll wait to see who he represents today. Welcome to the committee. Please say your name for the record and tell us for whom you are testifying.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Roger Arnson. I represent the Elementary and the Secondary Principals Association, and have had an opportunity to look at Representative Downey's bill, House File 269. I tell you that I read the amendment. I'll have an opinion on the amendment sometime late next week. That is a very complex amendment. A couple things about this that I think the discussion is always healthy. I know that it's a longstanding tradition among the members when you refer to, you know, my respected colleagues and my friends. We do that among the lobbying community as well. I mean, Gray Schwab and the School Board Association, we've always enjoyed a really good relationship among principals and the school boards, and also with the principals and the teachers, and with Mr. Bartholomew as well, and the business partnership. We bargain with school districts for principal contracts. We have 1,700 school principals in Minnesota. I actually personally do the bargaining for almost all of the large districts. I do Minneapolis, St. Paul, Anoka, Rochester, South Washington County, several others. And you brought principals into this bill. We're in the definition of teachers, and so you substantively change principal bargaining here. Some of it doesn't work, and I think as you go along in the process, you may want to talk about some of that. There's a reference to going in. First of all, principals don't have the right to strike. It'd be a pretty lame strike if we did. yeah, children might look at that as a holiday. But what the bill does is it says non-economic interests can go into arbitration. And I know that if you sit and look at this in a two-dimensional drafting sense, you could say, well, good, let's divide the economic and the non-economic. But I think there's some things you might want to think about as policymakers as you look on that. Is that going to drive a whole bunch of arbitration issues that are non-economic issues? Now people are going to have a real interest in litigating. Minneapolis just solved a significant issue with their teachers about the right of assignment into specific sites. The district had given away a lot of that. They wanted it back. They have a lot of interest in doing that. And they worked very, very hard to craft a settlement on that issue. If you had this bill, the economic piece would just be taken out of it. The district would mandatorily impose, if they wanted to, elected to, the whatever the increase was as it's defined, and then the teachers would litigate with a neutral the question of assignment into buildings. Would we also talk about litigating the seniority issues? Would we talk about litigating the discharge issues? Would we talk about litigating, you know, the prep times, the duty-free lunch, and a lot of the other issues? Binding those with the economic issues allows us to get them settled. And I can tell you, I do a lot of work with the Bureau of Mediation Services. That's a little group that's understaffed and underfunded, and we need more of. But the deputy director, Bob Weisenberger, every time he walks into one of the meetings, he says, what do we need to get a settlement here? And so things that you do on a policy level that drive getting settlements that everyone has a stake in, that aren't unilaterally imposed, that everyone's waded out into the water on, and that they've committed on, those are, I think those are the best settlements. You know, Ms. Schwab talks about rebalancing the bargaining table. That's tough business. And you think about how important having that balanced is. And just a little comment, and then I'll wrap it up here, Madam Chair, but we'd love to see principals out of this. We think our system works pretty well. We have binding arbitration. We might have one arbitration every 5 years. I mean, the major arbitration that we've had, the only one that we've had in the last five, is in St. Paul, and we arbitrated whether or not the 403B contribution should be raised by $1,000, the match, and we lost. Arbitration took a whole 2 hours. You know, I mean, it's not a particularly difficult process. It's pretty straightforward, and it works pretty well for us. But I might say that overall, you need to be really careful with the unintended consequences of this stuff and how you drive it. The major change that's happened in bargaining, and you've seen data, Representative Downey's seen it as well, about how few strikes we've had, et cetera, and if you look as to why we've had so few strikes, it's not because everybody's behaving so well, but it's because the quality of the data in bargaining has improved to such a level that now all of the parties know what the money is. 40 years ago, we had a lot of fights about, well, you're not telling us the truth about the money. We don't know how much money the district has. And we'd have a lot of consultants who would come in and say, well, you have this much and we have this much. Now, Tom Melcher and the department puts it all online. Everybody knows how much revenue is there. That's been completely taken out of the mix. The second thing is that the Internet has unclogged the information piece out to teachers in bargaining. Teachers now communicate very well with themselves about what's going on in bargaining. It's not just funneled through the union piece. A couple of years ago, South Washington County, the settlement almost went down with a little email stuff that was going on. So it's good to have these discussions. It's healthy to have these discussions. Setting the overall parameters of bargaining, that's your job. And as policymakers, you all ought to be aware of what's going on with this. But be careful. Don't go quickly on this. Think about it. You have a lot of resources to get data to help you in these decisions, you know, what have settlements have been and what drives them, and I'd urge you to access those, whether it's legislative audit or other spots as well. And we do think this is a good discussion to have, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Arnson.
Thank you very much.
And Education Minnesota, Jan Alswager. Welcome to the committee. Say your name for the record, and please proceed.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Jan Alswager, Education Minnesota, and I would agree with everything Mr. Aronson just said, and I believe that if you think that this is not good for principals and you take principals out, you should take teachers out as well.
Because so then we have no bills.
We do have very similar issues all of the much of the time, because we do bargain. Our groups are very, very similar. Mr. Aronson made some excellent points, so I won't repeat those. But this is a proposal that comes out of Wisconsin. I think that's very interesting. So it looks like we're headed, I hope we're not headed in the direction of Wisconsin. This is, as Mr. Bartholomew stated, it puts an emphasis on the salary issue, and the rest of those list of 11 items really are important to our members as well. Every district is unique. They have unique set of circumstances in terms of their personnel whether it be the age of the employee, the impact that has an impact on health insurance. There's life insurance. There's a whole number of factors. And what you are doing here is taking away the local control in that you're saying that salaries are now, that is the priority. Lanes aren't as important as the regular salary. And when you take away the right to strike, you are taking away some of the opportunity to have a good discussion, because the school board can simply say, we're offering zero. You know that we're going to have zero on the formula this year. And so a school board can go ahead and say zero, and there's really nothing that can be done about it. So I certainly don't agree that this isn't local control the way it is portrayed to be. Yes, a district could decide to opt out of this, but we think that this gives the district the upper hand, certainly. And we think that there's a lot of micromanagement in the bill. I believe I will just leave it at that, but also to say that Mr. Aronson made some comments about how negotiations is working very well. In addition to what he said about the data, now the January 15th contract settlement deadline, you've seen it all before. We've had three strikes in 17 years. All of with that, that's during the time that the January 15th settlement deadline was in place or out of place, and all those three strikes were when we didn't have the January 15th. We had some testimony from a president in Lakeville who said that in their negotiations, they made sure that the more veteran teachers had no increase except to help pay for some of their health insurance costs, and they made sure that the increase that they did give on the salary schedule was for the beginning teachers. And so that spirit of cooperation in collaborative bargaining is very important. You put a bill in like this, it really takes away that trust that we really do want to foster in a district, and so that we come to creative solutions. And I'm sure this bill will be going on to another committee, and I'll have another opportunity, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Alswiger. Members, this idea did not resurrect itself because of anything that's going on presently. When I served previously, the qualified economic offer wandered around a bill introduction. I believe it was carried by Representative Barb Sikora, maybe even Representative Alice Segrin, but it's something old that every once in a while comes back to remind us that maybe there's another way to deal with negotiations. With that, I think we have questions for you, Representative Downey, unless you want to make a statement before I ask the first questioner. Representative Downey?
Madam Chair, I actually do have a couple comments, but let's go to questions, and I can probably weave them into that.
And Representative?
Madam Chair,
yes.
For me, this is a new idea, not an old idea. So.
You bet it's a new idea for you, yes. Let's say the title.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
The title has been around for a while.
There's nothing new under the sun, right?
That's right. Representative Woodard.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Downey. This is a new idea for me as well, so I appreciate that. And I appreciate the fact that you're taking what I would consider a fairly unique approach to a very, very difficult situation. None of us want to freeze teacher pay, and I think this really is would represent a safeguard and an area for school boards and the collective units to be able to go to if they need to, and I appreciate that being an option for them. A couple of things. One is that when we look at the superintendents and the administrators within the bill, I think that it's important that they're part of that they are part of this QEO as well, because as you know, in the last couple of weeks, we've had superintendents reporting some fairly substantial bonuses, including Minnetonka getting a $57,000 bonus. I think that is really important that it remains part of this bill, and I appreciate you putting that in. My question really revolves around, though, the litigation piece that was discussed. Are you aware of where QEO has been implemented in other states where it has actually increased litigation or arbitration for these kinds of negotiations?
Representative Downey.
Madam Chair, can I perhaps ask Mr. Bartholomew?
Absolutely, Mr. Bartholomew, come to the table and answer that for us, since you've done a lot of research on this. Please say your name for the record again.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Representative Woodard, I am familiar with what's occurred in Wisconsin, and in fact, this is one thing. This is not a current Wisconsin law. It was repealed a couple of years ago. That said, I'm not aware that litigation has been a specific issue in relation to the implementation of their law. I'm not sure if that would come about or not, but as far as Wisconsin's experience, what we've been able to tell, that specifically hasn't been an issue.
But Representative Woodard.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Mr. Bartholomew.
Representative Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I note in some notes I have that 1999-2000 Representative Krenke first introduced this legislation, so it's been around quite a while, apparently. Representative Downey, it's nice to see you again. Representative Downey and I have kind of a shared history in a sense, because his father, one of the terrific teachers in Edina, was a colleague of mine for many, many years, and is still doing coaching and swimming. He's up to how many years now of coaching for Edina schools?
Madam Chair, either 55 or 56.
Incredible. Absolutely incredible. So not only a terrific coach, but a great teacher and human being as well. I just don't know exactly where to start with this. My observation here in the few years that I've been in the legislature is there's constant discussion about local control. And it seems that whenever it's convenient for the legislature, usually for economic reasons, local control notions go out the window. And then if it is convenient in some way for the legislature and the budget, then local control comes back in again. So I'm just curious, this is one quick question, and I can't take up all the time here, although I'd love to. What would be a motivation for a school board not to use QED?
Representative
Downey. I can't think of one.
A reason not to use.
Madam Chair, I'm struggling because it's a question of particular circumstance in a local district. I guess I could make up thousands of particular cases where they would choose not to.
Maybe a specific one?
Representative Downey.
Everyone feels very comfortable with the negotiations and the offer that's on the table. We're in a time of relatively adequate funding, and a district would choose not to. A long-term relationship between teachers in the district that is solid, and one in which the increases that have been negotiated over a period of time are adequate, and it's all part of an ongoing strategy that everyone's comfortable with. And I guess I would hope that would be the majority of cases, and it would only be on an occasional basis that the district would feel that this was a tool that they would want to avail themselves of. So I don't know if that's answering your question, Representative Benson.
Yeah. Well, Madam Chair, when Representative Krenke was proposing this back in 1999-2000, I was president of the local Edina Teachers Union, and very much involved in the negotiations. And I can tell you, as far as Edina is concerned, I never felt that I had some overweening powers over our local district. We all understood exactly how much money there was. And basically, Edina would wait around to see what Eden Prairie did, or what Minnetonka did, or Wayzata. And then the offer would come in somewhere within a few dollars one way or another, because all these districts in the Southwest Metro, and Madam Chair is nodding her agreement. We know how that kind of thing works, but I can assure anyone in this committee who has not been involved in teacher contract negotiations, the teachers' organizations do not have an overweening power in this process, quite the contrary. You know, I'm just thinking about other areas in the private sector, healthcare, for example. There is another essential service. And I'm just wondering whether Representative Downey, and this is just a rhetorical question, so I don't expect an answer, but whether he would propose caps, for example, on doctors' salary, because we know there's a significant number of people, I think it's up to nearly 50 million in the country now, who do not or cannot afford health care. So I'm just wondering whether or not this would be a great proposal in the private sector, simply to cap compensation for those who provide services when we see that there is harm being perpetrated on people who cannot receive health care. For example, and that's not a question for him, but just a general comment, and I'd like to pass it on to someone else. Since I've been here, my concern mostly with education has been how can we attract and retain the kind of people we want in the classroom? And I note that compensation for teachers in Minnesota has been dropping over the years. We're down to 20th now. Actually, the average compensation for teachers in Minnesota is below the national average. And we know that compensation is not the major reason many people go into education, but there ought to be a compensation that's at least competitive with the private sector. And when I was president of the union, my problem was to try to keep these young teachers teaching in Edina. And that last year, 1999, the average take-home after all the deductions for a teacher in Edina, and by the way, I agreed to work in Edina because I found their salary was exactly $100 a year more than Eden Prairie. So I jumped at this big improvement in my compensation. But my problem was that so many of these young people left because the private sector simply outcompeted us if you were good at math or science. And by the way, knew something more than George Washington threw a silver dollar across the Delaware, and people really wanted someone who was competent in the social sciences as well. We simply, even in 1999, could not compete with the private sector.
Representative Benson,
so my last point then is how will this not only compensate those that we want to keep in the profession, but attract and retain those that we are losing at the rate of nearly 50% after 3 or 4 years of teaching?
Representative,
thank
Duncan.
You.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Benson. An initial comment, and then I would like to, if I could, maybe address the three points that I think you broadly raised. You know, I personally, and I think most of us in our communities, absolutely believe in our teachers. Absolutely, 110%. And when we look at teachers in the eye, we believe in them. Many of us don't believe that the structures that they're locked into are the right structures for their full potential to be unleashed on behalf of our kids and our communities. And so I think what we're talking about isn't in any way to disparage teachers or you know, suggest that they're part of the problem. Frankly, I think what we're trying to do is create new structures that where the old ones have calcified and aren't serving their intended original purpose. So with that is just an overriding statement. You mentioned the kind of rolling settlements that occur in regions of the state and kind of how that plays together. And somehow I think you were making that a local control issue, and frankly, I think it's the reverse. And I'll just give you a case study, and I hate to bring my district forward like this, but just last year, and we heard about this in when we had my January 15th deadline bill here, I won't name the other districts, but there were some districts to the west of mine that settled for rather large numbers, and my district had a tentative agreement with a total 5.6% increase for teachers. That was accepted by the bargaining representatives. It was rejected by the teachers. My district then offered a 5.85% increase. That too was negotiated with the bargaining representatives and then rejected by the teachers. And we suffered the $230,000 penalty, which of course comes right out of the classroom the way it works. And so the pressure of what had happened in these other districts in fact totally abridged the local control. There was this kind of external market pressure that Edina had to respond to, and I don't know how all of this works statewide, whether there's an intentional strategy for what regions are going to settle first, and then the metrics get set and everybody kind of has to follow suit. But I would say against that regional or statewide pressure, this bill would actually give a local district an additional measure of control if their offer were a reasonable offer, as compared to having their offer constantly be benchmarked against other neighboring districts. You also mentioned the private sector, and I would argue that the private sector is extremely different. There's a built-in set of mechanisms that comes from shareholder return on investment and boards of directors down through the organization, and you just look at the paper today. I think it was Medtronic is going to have to lay off 2,000 people based on poor quarterly results, and so there's this kind of almost instant mechanism through market feedback that occurs in the private sector that we don't have so much in the public sector, and especially highly structured negotiating arrangements like this one. And then the last comment about market compensation, I couldn't agree with you more. I authored a bill last year, and I haven't dropped it in this year, but it's jacketed, and I'm going to, and that would allow an individual teacher to negotiate directly with the district. And I know some of these things were proposed and starting to be put in place out in Washington, D.C., and I believe teachers were able to make up into the six figures under some of the more creative kind of direct contracting arrangements that were being proposed there. And I know there was something in the Star Tribune recently that equated teacher hourly rates with other professions, accounting and even some management positions, and I think when you kind of drive it out to an hourly perspective, I'm not sure that teachers are radically underpaid, but they certainly aren't overpaid, and I think the structures that we're in today don't allow the best teachers to make market compensation for sure, and it probably does drive a lot of them out of the profession. I think there's some other solution strategies to that.
Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Madam.
I just had a quick follow-up. Thank you. You're very indulgent of me here. Well, you know, I was chief author of this self-governing schools legislation, which the governor signed into law. And it's my understanding that the Edina Schools is very close to adopting that. And so the notion that somehow finding fault with this bill does not mean that many of us believe in fundamental reform, including compensation, I think, is a misnomer. But I just needed to defend Edina in that regard and give them kudos. I hope they move quickly in that direction. But I also have to defend Minnetonka now, since it's one of the school districts I represent. And I'll just have to say, having been a union president, it's difficult for me to defend the large compensation here for the Minnetonka superintendent, except I have to say he was listed as one of the leaders in the entire educational field for the country. And I have to also say that Minnetonka has been extremely frugal and wise in its compensation, and I think that if a local district chooses to compensate teachers or superintendents or the janitors for exemplary service, they ought to be free to do that, just like we would in the private sector. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think it is a healthy discussion, and I like you, remember the last healthy discussion we had of this when Representative Sikora was chair of this committee, and I too think there's no ideas that are new on the face of the earth. I don't think there's been one bill this year so far in any of my committees that's not something I've heard at least once before or more. I have three things. One, and my ending with the third thing is a question for Madam Chair. One is we're all conflicted on when we're for local control and when we're not. I'm now this year not for local control when it comes to maintenance of effort of school support staff and so forth. But on this bill, I am for local control. And I do believe that local school boards do have the ability to say no. I've said to this committee many times, when I was a school board member, I was the same kind of school board member as I am legislator, and I was fully able to say no. And the public are the shareholders of the school districts, and if they don't like what their school board members are doing, they can elect them out and get new ones if they think their school board members are in the pocket of the teachers union and just have to give away the store at the expense of students. I'm thinking, Representative Downey, that this bill could actually drive up compensation costs. I think it's kind of like you have to use it or lose it in your budget at the end of the year. Here, if your next negotiation is going to be contingent upon what the last one was, then it seems to me you might be looking to keep things going and not be so reasonable about finances. And then my last question, just to know how healthy the discussion will be or how exercised we should be about this. I remember getting really exercised when Representative Sikora brought in people from Wisconsin to tell us about their plan that I don't notice it solved all the ills of that state. Even though they've repealed it, I didn't know Iowa had it. But in the Pioneer Press today, Madam Chair, I read that Majority Leader Matt Deans said that, and I'm trying to remember exactly what it was, but it was something about this is not going to be a session where we get into infringing collective bargaining rights or something of that sort. And so I'm thinking we don't need to get too exercised about this bill or this discussion if he's speaking for the caucus. Yesterday we had a little preview of how exercised this topic can be with Chair Garofalo throwing it into an unrelated bill through some sort of tick in his chairing of the committee, and to the point where perhaps there was cause and effect that he's canceled the committee meeting for this afternoon that's on, again, bashing unions in my interpretation. So my question then, Madam Chair, is this bill going anywhere this year? Are we going to follow what Majority Leader Deans had to say, or is this a real discussion?
Well, Representative Greiling, this bill is going to be recommended to pass and be referred to K-12 Finance, and Representative Garofalo and our committee there will make a decision. I think this is an option. It's one kind of reform, and when Representative Downey talked to me about it, I said, yeah, I've heard this before, and so bring forth the new version. Did you have a question for Representative Downey?
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. Since you were maybe unable to answer the question, I'm wondering if Representative Downey has discussed this legislation with his caucus, with Majority Leader Dean, and do you see this, I see it as a conflict in his statement that I read in the Pioneer Press this morning. Do you not see it as a conflict, or haven't you discussed this with him?
Representative Downey.
Madam Chair, Representative Greiling. So one thing I have learned in my short time down here is that the presentation of our quotes in the paper probably need to be verified with the individual who issued them, because I myself have been misquoted, partially quoted, and quoted out of context on a variety of issues. I know my own personal statements, and I think our caucus position is that the cost of state government has been literally growing twice the rate of the rest of the economy for 25 years. It's unsustainable. We can pretend it's not. We can band-aid our way there with, federal stimulus money or with, blink-on tax increases, and then the deficits come right back. And so absent some kind of fundamental structural reforms in what we're doing, probably across all program areas and across all operational functions of what we're doing at the state and the relationship between the state and the local governments is just unavoidable over the next few years. So I think, and I'll defer to Representative Dean, I know my comments on these very questions when people try to accuse me of union bashing, which I'm not. I think I'm empowering people and trying to get structures out of the way that impede people from really accomplishing the results we need as a state. No one's trying to tear down collective bargaining. We're focused on solving this unsustainable cost structure in state and local governments. And, you know, of necessity, workforce-related issues are going to have to be a part of that. There's just no way to get around it. And even in the governor's own budget, he proposed a 6% reduction in the executive branch agencies. He's choosing to do it through layoffs. The bill I proposed, which would have gotten us there a little more gradually, assumed that attrition and natural retirements and early retirements would have gotten us there. So I think to characterize this bill or Representative Dean's comments we're either union bashing or we're not this session, I don't think that's a fair characterization. We got a big challenge. We need to engage and empower our people to be part of the solution, and I think that's what we're all driving towards.
And Representative Downey, just to respond to your comments, you know, these are ideas for bargaining units and school boards to think about in the frame of the economics of setting the negotiations. So we don't have to use this idea in its entirety, but the fact that we have resurrected this for school boards and bargaining units to think about, I think, is invaluable. Just to think about within the realm of bargaining is looking at the economics of things valuable. And I think it is. Representative Greiling, to that point.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I strongly agree and certainly will give Representative Downey what's quoted in the paper is often I'm very surprised at my own quotes. So I'm sympathetic with that. And so I know this is coming to the E-12 Finance Division. And so I would request at least that you discuss it with Representative Deans between now and then so that when I ask you the same question there, I'll have a good idea of how much energy to put into the discussion.
Representative Kath, did you have something to that point?
Not to that point.
Thank you. Representative Tilbury.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I do have a question and a couple of comments. Representative Downey, there was one comment that you had made regarding Medtronic, which is kind of close to my heart in my district, and laying off 2,000 workers. And the assumption that I get is that you kind of feel like whatever the corporations decide, that's kind of what should be. Like there's no questioning of that what they've done. Because I look back a year ago and they had a 129% increase in their cash on hand just a year ago, more than they had in 2008. And also the quarterly profits, if you look at them, you would wonder, why are they making this decision to lay off 2,000 workers? So I would think that you better check into that a little bit on that before making the comment. The other piece is that this does take away, this particular piece does encourage school districts to just use it. Why waste time? Just use it. We can solve our settlement. That's why the School Board Association ran right up here and said, let's use it. Because they know it's a valuable tool that they will use, and it is a problem for unions because it does take away some of their pieces that they have at the table. I'm in kind of a unique position. I served on the negotiations team for the teachers union at Roseville Area High School, or schools, Roseville Area Schools. But in another time, I also served on the school board for Fridley. So I've been on the negotiations table on both sides. Not at the same time, obviously, but have seen the different ways of negotiating and the different ways people do things with it. And I do go back to local control. And I have to say the same thing about local control as far as the MOE goes into to aspect. I do find myself at that same contradiction, you might say. But I think that it's important that this gets exposed to what it really is, and that is just a tool for schools to use, which it's going to be the tool. They won't need to use others. And that's what my fear is on this particular piece.
And your question, Representative Tilbury?
Well, my other one was more specific as far as the November or the January 15th date. If they put this in place, are they still obligated to come to the table after that, or do they get penalized because of it? Is there really a contract that's settled at that point?
Representative Downey.
Madam Chair, I'm not sure I totally understood the question. I guess if you envision the passage and signing of some fix to the January 15th contract deadline penalty, and I think there was quite a bit of discussion and I think some consensus that a deadline or some kind of line in the sand makes sense. I mean, clearly that would have to be developed in a way that was complementary to this provision. I don't think the two are mutually exclusive, at least in my own mind. But the concept of this passing and January 15th reform and other reforms passing, clearly they'd all have to be made complementary and not contradictory in their final pass, in the form that they'd be passed finally. So I don't know if I understood or answered your question.
Representative Tilbury, do you want to clarify?
Yeah, maybe you're not clarifying, and maybe I'm not doing a good job of asking it, but that just kind of lends the confusion that I have to what's happening in the bill. The other piece is, do you know when negotiations typically start for a cycle? And I was curious why it was on the first year that you talked about this happening.
Representative Downey.
Madam Chair and Representative Tilbury, my understanding is that if a district is proactive and the teachers are proactive, they're literally starting a year, 9 months before the January 15th deadline as it currently exists, and they're working hard over the summer and into the fall. And in terms of the first year, I think I'd be open to other suggestions if the average of the 2 years would make more sense. I don't think I'm locked into this. I think the attempt was to find a number that would be representative of a good common sense metric, and working on that going forward is I'm definitely open to that. There's nothing hard and fast cast in stone here in terms of this particular proposal.
The reason that I mentioned that, Madam Chair,
Tilbury,
is that a lot of times contracts are built in a way that everything's backloaded into the second year, and they take the first year as kind of an adjustment period for the school district to really get a good grip of what's happening. And so if you put everything based on the first year, you're basically kind of destroying that method of the biennium. And so I'd be interested to seeing something that might go in that direction instead.
Representative Downey.
Madam Chair, point well taken. I think that's a valuable input, and we can, if this bill does advance, that'd be something we'd need to figure out. And if I could, Madam Chair, just to respond to a couple of Representative Tilbury's points
Downey,
that were,
please,
in some ways questions, I think. If this weren't a valuable tool for districts, I wouldn't be proposing the bill. So I agree with you. It is a valuable tool, and hopefully toward an outcome that we all share. We might disagree over the means, but hopefully the ends we're in agreement on. And with regard to Medtronic, I just want to be clear. I think attempting to respond to Representative Benson's question about the private sector, and it was an example that came to mind because I saw in the paper this morning that they had reacted very quickly, and they weren't reacting to their cash position or their profitability of a year ago. They were reacting to their future growth projections and what they could reasonably expect. And again, there's this almost instantaneous market communication between customers and shareholders and CEOs and operations people in the private sector that we don't totally have in the public sector. And so I think when we always try to lay some private sector techniques and tools, and I'm a big fan of that, but we need to always, of course, realize that the public sector is different from the private. And so I was trying to contrast the private sector as compared to the public sector in my response to Representative Benson.
Representative Depke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question, and I also have a comment. My question really was very similar to Representative Tilbury's regarding the January 15th deadline. And I just want to clarify, I think I heard you say, since you are, I think you're the chief author also on January 15th, and my question was, what would happen to this bill if that actually passed? But I heard you say that both bills are healthy independently, and that you don't see any real conflict between the two of them, even though they both have that January 15th deadline provision in it. Is that what I heard you say?
Representative Downey.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Dupke. I think yes. I mean, clearly these two bills, if they were actually ended up implemented, would need to be complementary to each other, and so I'm sure some tweaking of the provisions in both standalone bills as they exist now would need to be done to make sure they work well together, and it would be part of an overall, I think, you know, reform idea that would need to come out of a final omnibus K-12 bill.
Thank you, Representative Downey. Madam Chair, may I make a comment, please?
Go ahead, please.
Thank you very much. I appreciated the discussion on what can be said in the newspaper and so forth, and I'm responding to Representative Woodard's comment, as Representative Benson did, to the high salaries or bonuses that were reported by KSTP. Yes, I represent Minnetonka as well, and also Orno, who was listed as the second one, which was a $25,000 bonus, as well as a Minnetonka $57,000. I have been in contact with the board in both of those districts, and just to give you an information, both boards were amazed that those numbers came out. They don't know where they came from. As far as the superintendent in Minnetonka is concerned, he received his highest bonus ever last year at 15% of his base salary. It was nowhere near $57,000. And he did that because Minnetonka became the second school district, along with Edina, to receive AAA rating from Moody's. So, and that was one of his goals and that he had to obtain. The other one was that he was elected Superintendent of the Year and got national recognition for his work. And in addition, and the third thing was is that their open enrollment went up. Many students, even Representative Loon told me that they have many students are going to Minnetonka. There is some controversy in the Eden Prairie School District, and so students are open enrolling to Minnetonka because of the different programs and the type of education. So that's the story on that. Now, as far as Orno is concerned, Orno superintendent got a 5% raise, a bonus, and bonus programs are part of the superintendent's negotiations, obviously, with very strict goals. Orno just received an international award for communication with their district. This is one of the things that I've been pushing them to go for. I feel that they needed to be more open with their community, and in addition to that, without being too prescriptive, but also their board had pushed their superintendent to do that as well. And they also, fiscally are fiscally sound. They are not AAA rated, but she received a 5% bonus based on her efforts in communication with the district. It was nowhere near $25,000.
Thank you for those clarifications. Representative Barrett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess a thought and a couple questions. I'm not sure who this question would be for. Maybe it would be for Mr. Bartholomew or Ms. Allswager. But whoever has an answer, please chime in. Seems like this is a bill related to attaching the revenue going into a district with the expenses going out of the district so that the two match up, similar to what I think Representative Downey alluded to in the private sector. For me, maybe a better example would be a nonprofit in the private sector, which I am familiar with, in which you need to reach a bottom line. And so it's just a question of what you do with the money left over at the end of the day, but still the idea is to reach a bottom line and using the available revenue. And so with that, I guess, I'm wondering how many districts in the last contract settlement period reached agreements with teachers that were above the basic formula amount?
Mr. Bartholomew.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Barrett. We haven't had a chance to go through all 340-ish districts. What we've done is go through, because you'd have to go through, what we've done is looked at the statewide averages for total package increases on an annual basis and then compared that to the state formula increases. To see where the formula, what's the formula increase, that's the bar of what's going in, and then the total package increases the bar for what's going out. And we can share this if you want, but in 9 of the last 12 years that the most recent data is available for, the settlements have exceeded the formula increase.
Madam Chair.
Representative Barrett.
Sure. And then following up to that, I think that's probably a better analogy. What do you know at all what the total value of the compensation was in the last contract period for a period of time in which there was zero increase in the formula, I believe?
Mr. Bartholomew.
Madam Chair, Representative Barrett, I can follow up. Sure. I've got some of that information in my packet here. It's based the value of the total package increases. Is that what you're looking
yes.
for?
Yes.
I think MSBA reports that.
You know, that's
the most recent year I've got. Now the copy here that I have, and frankly, I might ask Ms. Kelleher to confirm, but one of the sheets that they have, total statewide averages, total package increases a percent, and then they have a dollar amount for average each year. And the dollar amount in 2009 was $2,542 as a statewide average. I don't know if that's helpful. I've got the other years if you'd like, and be happy to get that.
If I could follow up, Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Barrett.
I think where I'm going with this is I'm wondering, I believe that the total compensation that was increased in the last contract period was several million dollars, if not hundreds of million dollars. The low hundreds, I believe, from the information I remember from researching that in the last year.
Mr. Bartholomew.
Madam Chair, Representative, my numbers are on a per-teacher basis.
Right.
So, yeah.
Okay. So given that, then
Representative Barrett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If the increase in expense is several hundred million dollars and the districts don't have that money, where does that money come from?
Mr. Bartholomew.
Madam Chair, Representative Barrett, that, from our perspective, that was the whole point of Representative Downey's bill, is when districts' expenditures exceed available revenues, really the only big place they have to go is people, and primarily classroom teachers. And that's our, we would like to find a way to keep teachers in the classroom. And it's not a question of teachers are overpaid. It's a question of trying to find that balance between providing appropriate salaries without having to also cut teaching positions and then cutting the program offerings. As I mentioned, we're open to if there's another way to go about this, you know, we'd be happy to look at that. But every year we see, you know, there are reports, districts every year cutting teachers, cutting programs, and there are better ways to go about. We don't have to be in that position, and we'd like to try to find a way to get out of that position.
Representative Barrett?
No, that answers my question perfectly, which is exactly where I was going. And given the districts I represent, and some of the districts did have a situation where their increase in compensation exceeded the formula that they were given for that period of time. And so in January, then, with the deadline, January 14th, I believe, is when this particular contract I'm thinking of was signed, an increase in the school's budget amounted to about $800,000. In a situation where they didn't have $800,000 to provide. So what happened in May and June is teachers were cut. And if you look at that from a kids first, no exceptions, no excuses, that's a very bad situation that really, for a parent, for a school board member, for a child, which is why we're all here, that's a situation you're trying to change. And so I commend you for that. Thank you.
Representative Peterson Sandra.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's been an interesting discussion, and I don't recall the bill from before. This is the first time for me, too, and it is very complex. Many questions about details, but I'm not going to take time for that. I'm more interested in, you know, the total budget that a school has. They have it's not just teacher salaries. In fact, my first question would be if, and I don't know which of the two of you could answer this, what percentage, first of all, I think the percentage of a total budget in a district for all of the money that they have, about 85% goes to human resources, people of some kind. What percentage do you have an average statewide that, what percentage of that amount goes to teacher salaries?
Madam Chair.
Mr. Bartholomew.
Representative Peterson, the last data I was able to find on that was, frankly, in the Star Tribune's report in 04, and they had the exact same percentage as you did, and they concluded that well over half of that 85% goes to teacher salaries.
Salaries and benefits.
Compensation. Pardon.
Compensation. Okay. And Madam Chair?
Representative Peterson.
That's higher than I thought the amount had been going down. So, you know, each year, in terms of the amount of compensation or amount of the total package that went to teachers, it certainly is. We're about 20th in the nation. I know that. We're, in terms of our results, we're very high. In terms of student results, at least with ACTs and SATs and the rest, but we are at about 20th in the nation, as I recall, in teacher salaries, and it's been compensation and steadily going down. Would you agree with that,
Mr. Bartholomew?
Madam Chair, Representative Peterson, in the absence of better data in front of me, I'm happy to agree with you on that. And again, our point isn't to say that teachers are overpaid or we've seen over years and years and years, every spring and summer and fall, districts have to say they need to cut teachers and programs because they can't afford their expenditures have exceeded revenues. And we're trying to save teaching positions in our support to this bill. It's not an argument that teachers are being overpaid and that we shouldn't be first in the country on a percentage basis or in a ranking. But rather, we're trying to find a way to keep teachers in the classroom as best we can. And then you fold into that the need to attract and retain younger teachers. The current system, every time a district has to lay someone off, it's the younger teachers that go first that we're going to so desperately need. So we're trying to find a balance.
And Madam Chair.
Representative Peterson.
Yeah, you know, the rest of the, let's say it's 50% of that 85 is spent on teacher compensation. This bill doesn't address what you're doing with the other bargaining units. Are you going to come in with the same kind of proposal for the rest of the bargain units, too?
Representative Downey.
Madam Chair, I'd be very receptive to that discussion.
I thought you would. Just to give them a heads up.
Representative Peterson, follow up.
And last but not least, have you discussed this with the Department of Education or the governor?
Representative Downey.
Madam Chair, Representative Peterson, no, I have not.
Thank you.
Representative Kath.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First off, just a comment overall, and I think that this is something all of us as members need to take into consideration, and that is that this is a one-size-fits-all approach that really does need to be decided at a local level. And I think I have to echo what we've been talking about here, and that is that the information is there, and districts are doing a job, including my own. I've taken, in my 11 years of teaching, a hard freeze twice, which means that I did no steps, no lanes, and didn't get compensated for my master's degree the first year. And so when we're looking at this, there are districts that are doing responsible negotiations and bargaining, and many of us as teachers are willing to give to say that we need to look out for that either top tier, those retirees that are going out, and there's times that we also look out for those new teachers that are coming in. But Mr. Bartholomew, I have to take offense to the fact that this type of approach is not going to attract new teachers. So it might retain, and I think some of us, you know, I would say that there's some evidence here that might be able to retain. But when I'm talking to people that are interested in going into teaching, this is not an attractable piece of negotiation here. And I have to just be very honest about that. This is not about attracting teachers. Beyond that is that once you open this up to not only teachers, principals, and superintendents, we know that leadership in our schools is very critical. And specifically, every school district right now, and depending on the school itself, has very specific needs, whether it's a school that's on AYP, whether it's a district that's on AYP. You would lose, Representative Depke, the opportunity for your school board to even negotiate some of these types of bonuses for getting off of AYP or to move into some of these goals and things that people are trying to set. And I guess where I'm going at with this is the fact that let school boards do their job. And if a school board isn't, then as a representative, I want to talk to that school board and say, you know, why aren't you looking at the best interest of the school as a whole? Why aren't you doing your job here? You know, I think we have to put a little bit more trust into our school boards and to say that we up here do not have the answer for every school district across the state here. And I think that's what this proposal is trying to do. So I'm struggling with that. But the question I do have, Madam Chair, is how does this take into account fund balances, specifically a district wanting to increase a fund balance or a district that has a substantial fund balance? How would that play into this?
Representative Downey.
Madam Chair, the bill is silent with respect to fund balances. Representative Kath.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And members, I think that's something to take into consideration here. My district, for instance, built up a fund balance over many years to the point that it was over 17% of our entire school budget. And they knew that in that situation that they were building it up to say then after those years, and Representative Barrett, what you were talking about is that when your revenues weren't coming in because you knew the state was hitting hard times, they built that up so that they could use it in those times so that they could sustain and maintain the staffing ratios that are there and to, you know, adequately compensate people for benefits and things like that. It's silent on that. And looking through here, that is what a good school district is doing. They're looking at the long-term and solutions there. So really what this would do, members, is it would prohibit a school district from wanting to even develop a fund balance for the future because in some situations, in good economic times, the teachers would push for the qualified economic, you know, indicator here. So I don't know. I just think that overall we have to let our school boards do their job. I think they're doing a good job. I haven't gotten rich quick by being a teacher over the last 11 years. And I'll tell you, overall, we've been able to keep, you know, good teachers in our classrooms as well as to make sure that we put the students first. So I think this is a solution in search of a problem and that we need to make sure that it's local control that's taking care of this. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Downey.
Yeah, Madam Chair, if I could just respond real quick. I think it's important to focus on what's in the bill and not some of the side points here. But Representative Kath, my observation is that your district, given what you described, would never avail itself of the QEO option. And I have heard a couple of times where comments have been made that have attempted to, I think somebody, Ms. Alschwager might have said that this bill attempts to micromanage. I mean, I really struggle to find that anywhere in the bill. It's an option that a district can avail itself of. The hope is that every district would be like yours, Representative Kath, and they their strategy is to manage a fund balance to prepare for a rainy day so they can buffer themselves against these kinds of funding shortfalls at the state, economic downturns. I would commend them for that. And if the local community is good with that, having that kind of a fund balance and that kind of a reserve, and they're willing to, you know, support that locally, more power to them. But that has nothing to do with the bill. The bill just says that if a district is going to offer an offer to the teachers that's at least equal to the state funding increase, that there's not a strike. So it's one tool. We keep hearing that this somehow abridges local control. It is absolutely a tool that districts can opt into, so I don't know how anybody could see it as anything other than local control. And we've kind of gotten off into a separate side discussion, too, about whether this attracts teachers or doesn't. And I talk about my business, 20% pay cuts and laying off 20% of my management consulting group over the last few years was not a huge attractant to new candidates. And I think just the reality of what's happened in the marketplace is that that's all over the place. And so to, I think, attack this bill as somehow saying it's not going to attract teachers, I mean, the reality of where we're at is not a great attractant anywhere, and I think this is just giving districts a tool to manage themselves fiscally in a way that they haven't been able to in the past.
Representative Kahn.
Follow-up, Madam Chair. But what I'm saying is by being silent on a fund balance here, really what you're saying then is that last year we had a 0%, so the... Really what they're saying is that the school board could, if they wanted to maintain that, that fund balance at a 17% or whatever it is, they could offer this, and then it would take away the right of a teacher's union somewhere down the road of being able to strike, of saying that this is fair compensation, and would actually then go against your statement of trying to retain teachers into the classroom. And so overall, I guess I think a fund balance does need to be brought into this legislation if it's actually going to look at the total revenue that is available to keep teachers and to have a, I think, a balanced approach to how we negotiate, because that is revenue that is available, and school districts have that available for those types of situations.
Representative Downey.
Madam Chair, the bill is silent on all kinds of things. It's silent on levies. It's silent on capital projects. It's silent on site-governed schools. It's silent on thousands of things, intentionally so. It is just designed to be one option that a school district could use, and I would fully expect that the school district would be accountable to its community if it ever did choose to use this as well. So this assumption that somehow we're putting districts into a certain kind of relationship with their district and their community is, it's not in the bill. It's just another tool to help them manage their cost structure when and if they need to.
Representative Mariani.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Excuse me. This question is for Mr. Bartholomew, and I'm sitting here kind of struggling a little bit with the conversation, because I think we kind of keep touching on what the bigger issue is, or at least what I think ought to be a more balanced conversation here. And I think Representative Barrett actually got us going in that direction a little bit, and so did Representative Peterson. You know, it seems to me, I don't know, maybe I'm just the real simple kind of guy, but, you know, it seems to me if you don't want to cut teachers, then we ought to properly fund the general formula. And having said that, I don't think that, I don't think that Representative Downey's creative proposal here is an inappropriate proposal. I just think that we're only dealing with one part of the equation. And while we explore this part of the equation in terms of dealing with realities on the ground, we ought to deal with what we're doing with the general fund formula for education in the state. And so, Mr. Bartholomew, in your policy brief where you lay out the argument why the QEO is necessary, you talk about school boards unwilling to suffer teacher strike and therefore, you know, resulting in inability to keep settlements in line with with available resources. And by the way, we've heard repeatedly and we have it pretty well documented and quantified in this state that our state's teachers are not, I believe I'm correct though when I say this, we're not even paid at the national average of teachers. And I know my household, you know, when I go to Cub or Rainbow or Kowalski or wherever I go to pick up, you know, my food, that, you know, it seems like almost sometimes, Madam Chair, on a week-by-week basis, I'm looking at new costs. I don't have any control over those costs. I don't suspect that when you're sitting at the negotiating table that you're bringing in the healthcare providers and the various vendors and forcing them to be part of the conversation about what ought to be a fair settlement, but what they do absolutely has every bearing on your ability to come up with a fair settlement. And so, Mr. Bartholomew, the question is kind of begging here, you know, available resources. And so I guess my question for you very quickly is, does the business partnership support the state funding the general education formula consistently, at least at the rate to be able to meet inflationary costs. And I'll point out that, you know, in 2004, the first year increase in the allowance was 0%. I think we probably had inflation in 2004. In 2010, 0%. I suspect in 2012, given what we're, how we're, some of us are approaching how to deal with our state's finances, we're probably back at 0%. And so my question again, then, Mr. Bartholomew, is a business partnership. I get that you're supporting this particular tool. I think Representative Downey has some meritorious proposals and ideas to put on the table as part of, as one part of a solution. But in terms of dealing with the very real issue that you identified here of available resources, does a partnership support the state adhering every year to consistently funding the formula, at least to meet inflationary costs, and therefore does the business partnership support the state raising the revenues in order to be able to do that?
Mr. Bartholomew.
Madam Chair, Representative Mariani, a couple thoughts. One, that's a reason why we supported linking this to the formula allowance, in the sense that with that type of a link, when the legislature spends a dollar on K-12, that would be an incentive to put it on the formula allowance, and we viewed that as the most equitable way to distribute that dollar, because everybody gets the same amount. So we had a preference for the formula allowance on that basis. Would we support increasing the formula allowance automatically by the rate of inflation? No. That kind of puts things on autopilot. You may want to raise the formula by more than inflation. You may find yourself in the situation that you are today and you can't provide inflation. I don't think it would be a good idea to just put something like that in there and then you have no flexibility with it. That said, do we think we should provide adequate funding for education? Absolutely. Education is the state's top priority. And I don't think, well, I'm pretty sure you've never heard us say you should cut education because we need to fund something else. So I don't know if that's answering your question.
Madam Chair, it's fair enough, and I appreciate the direct answer. I just want to acknowledge the obvious, which is that we live on autopilot. When I go to Rainbow, you know, I'm on autopilot. I suspect that, I'm engaged in a dynamic that puts me on autopilot. I'm paying, you know, 5 cents more for that gallon of milk, and I suspect the same thing is happening at our collective bargaining tables across the state. And so, it's kind of nice to say, and Mr. Bartholomew, you and I go back, you know, a few years, and I have a lot of respect for you, but, you know, it's nice to say that, you know, we don't want to cut education, but when we ignore the reality on the ground, and we do 0%, formula allowance increases, we are, in fact, cutting K-12 education. I mean, either we're cutting it or someone out there, you know, our vendors are cutting it. And, you know, at the end, the result is still the same. We're going to wind up losing teachers. We're going to wind up subjecting our children to a lesser quality and a lesser opportunity. It's a tough conundrum. I get it, you know. I'm just saying that if we're going to put forward proposals like this, then I think we need to be talking about the entire continuum of how we can address the reality on the ground of diminishing available resources that our schools have to deal with year after year after year.
Mr. Barthel.
Madam Chair, Representative Mariani, totally sympathetic to where we are today. But I would also mention, in the long term, the state has provided formula allowance increases of 13.1%, 5.99%, 5.9%, and even in some of those years, settlements exceeded the increases in the allowance. And that just on a long-term basis, you can only spend so much before your revenues run out. I tend to agree with you whether you're going to Cub or the local gas station. But generally, I don't get an increase in my paycheck, and I used to like to go to Byerly's or Lund's, I'm going to look, and that then becomes too expensive. I'm going to look for options. Either I'm going to save some money somewhere else so I can still go there, or I'm going to look for somebody who can give me what I want, but at a little bit less. From what we can see, generally speaking, when districts are tight, and as a parent in a school district, I get frustrated in the sense that when the district has to cut funding, the first things they look at are teachers and programs. Now, they may have been looking at other things and they just don't tell us that, but that's what we see. And I think it would be helpful if we tried to find places to be more efficient, save our money so we can put it into the classroom. But when we see cuts, the first thing we see are teachers and programs and nothing else. And so I totally agree. I guess leave it at that.
Representative Downey.
Madam Chair, and I apologize. I think I'm at a position where I might need to duck out to get to a vote in another committee. I know that's bad form as we're coming to a vote on my bill in your committee. But I did have a quick response, and Representative Mariani, as per usual, raises really excellent points, and the points that have been made here on many fronts are excellent points, and ones that I'm very willing to try and consider as the bill would advance. But your comment about ignoring the reality on the ground, I think, is an appropriate one. And one of the first things I did when I got down here to the state was just to take a look at our overall spending patterns. And I went back to 1985 just to do a 25-year look back and realized that had we actually increased overall state funding at the rate of population growth and inflation, you can use even use your implicit price deflator if you like. I don't like that measure, but even doing that, had we increased over the last 25 years at that rate, we'd have a very large surplus this year. And the reality is that state spending has grown much faster than the rest of the economy and our ability to support it. And the economic downturn has simply kind of caused us very abruptly to come face-to-face with that reality. And we would have come face-to-face with that reality even in a good economy. You just can't have the states growing at literally twice the rate of the rest of the economy in our state and think that you're not going to hit a brick wall. And so we are there, and we need to course correct. And this may seem like a little bit of a blunt instrument. I'd love to actually provide even more flexibility so there were a little more market factors in play for teachers, and that our really excellent teachers, that I as a community member would be in a position to say, yeah, let's reward those people. But we've got what we've got, and this is an attempt to provide right now, given the circumstances that we're in and the need for this course correction, one tool for districts that they can avail themselves of, not have to avail themselves of. So with that, I hope nobody had other questions for me, but if you don't mind, I'm just going to duck to my other committee real quick, and if I can get back, I will.
Thank you, Representative Downey. I don't think you have to worry about coming back. Representative Keel, can your question be asked of Mr. Bartholomew?
Actually, it's a comment.
Go ahead.
Representative Peterson made the comment that we need to extend this to other bargaining units. My experience with negotiations with the district entities is everyone waits till the teacher's contract is decided, and then they all line up and follow along with whatever is done. And so I appreciate Representative Downey's tool that is offered to school boards, because it just really helps. It's another way of helping with negotiations when you get stuck with issues. I just find it very, I found it very interesting that the bargaining groups never wanted to discuss things until we'd had the teachers union decided. So,
thank you, Representative Keel. Representative Barrett, did you have a final comment you wanted to make? I realized that I skipped you because I wanted to get those who hadn't asked questions before to get ask a question. But comment, Representative Barrett.
Sure. Thank you for your apology, Chair Erickson. I appreciate that. No, I wanted to put a plug in for Costco because I'm a Costco member, so we talk about grocery stores. And so I want to put a plug in there. But really, it's regarding the fund balance thought. And I guess my thoughts are I would be loath to creating a long-term expense using a short-term supply of money. I think that historically, and we're talking about issues related to pensions and such that were created at a time with fund balances that were high. So I would question that as a long-term solution, but I see this as a compensation-neutral bill. We have a supply of money based on a budget that will not change. This bill will not change the budget, the revenue available to a district. It won't. But it will create jobs. This is a jobs bill. This will give that compensation and move that compensation throughout a greater supply of teachers, which will create jobs and also improve class sizes. I think that is very important, and that's why I would support a bill, this bill. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Barrett. I think you made some good closing comments. With that, members, I move that House File 269, as amended, be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Education Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, same sign.
No.
The bill is passed and re-referred to the Committee on Education Finance. Members, we are adjourned.